It's Sunday, October 15th, 2006. You're moving at the speed of creativity with Wesley Fryer, narrowcasting from Wichita Falls, Texas. Good evening from rainy and cool Wichita Falls, Texas. I am down here for the Region 9 Wichita Falls Area Technology Conference that will be taking place tomorrow, and we'll be sharing several presentations with local educators here. And I wanted to take some time tonight to publish what I think will be the first of two podcasts. This podcast I'm entitling Free Digital Curriculum. But before I get into the details of that, I want to give a plug for the K-12 Online Conference. And that will be actually beginning tomorrow, October 16th, 2006, with the publication of a pre-conference keynote by David Warlick. And I will include in the podcast show notes a link to the conference blog. You can find that at k12onlineconference.org. And the idea of this conference, I think, is absolutely fantastic. And it is that for teachers around the world to learn about the ways Web 2.0 or read-write web tools are being utilized in classrooms across the planet, the best way is really to let other educators teach other educators. And so I was spending several hours this past weekend aggregating together the conference schedule. I've been working with Cheryl Nussbaum-Beach and Darren Kropotois and with Will Richardson as well to put, really just kind of convene the conference, and it is amazing to see the schedule, and I'll put a link to the actual schedule in the podcast show notes too. And I hope you'll take a look at that and that you'll share this with other people, because I really think this is going to be an outstanding opportunity to get a fantastic insight into the ways that creative teachers around the world are using Web 2.0. I commented to, I think, Darren last night when we were having a Skype talk that this may be the best conference I've ever been a part of before, because whenever you attend a face-to-face conference, there are all these trade-offs because you can't go to every session, obviously. You have to pick and choose. And the amazing thing about K-12 Online, being an online conference, is that if somebody would want to, and there is no time restriction in terms of everyone having to do that the week of the conference or the 2 weeks that the main conference will be going on, people can listen to each and every presentation and participate in them. So David Warlick's pre-conference keynote will be published tomorrow on October the 16th, and the conference itself will officially kick off with the publishing of two sessions per day starting on Monday, October the 23rd, and that will be continuing through the week of October 30th through the 3rd. There's a series of live events that are planned, and anyway, I just really encourage you to check that out and get involved, because there'll be a lot of different ways, not only, of course, to listen to the content and the message, but participate via comments, via a blog, or I'm sorry, via a wiki that is being created, and via a series of different live events. So it's a little shameless plug there for K-12 Online, but again, this is an entirely non-commercial for free conference. We are going to be using Illuminate, but also a lot of other tools, including Tapped In, which, if you're not familiar with Tapped In, is a great text-based environment for educators to connect and collaborate. And anyway, I think it's just going to be great. The heart of tonight's podcast is a recording of a presentation that I gave several weeks ago, and I entitled the presentation Free Digital Curriculum. I had the opportunity to share 9 different presentations in different places across the state of Oklahoma in September, and these presentations focused on 2 things: E-rate updates for educators, administrators, and others that are involved in acquiring and securing E-rate funding for schools. And the afternoon session talked about free digital curriculum, because whether you live in the United States or not, getting access to the internet and getting that access is just part of the struggle to improve educational outcomes for students via technology. perhaps the even more challenging part is, what do we do with the bandwidth that we have? Where do we find digital curriculum? And the good news is that there are more options and possibilities available today for free on the internet when it comes to sources of educational curriculum than ever before. I do mention a brief example in the podcast or in the presentation that was to the Explore Learning gizmos as an example of what I would consider to be transformative level technology use. But with the exception of that, I think every other tool that I mentioned is a free tool, and rather than list each of those individually in the podcast show notes, I will include a link to the Digital Curriculum Wiki page, which I've created and I'm continuing to update. That includes links to the resources that I'm mentioning here. So, as always, I welcome any of your feedback on the podcast. You can always find me at my website, www.westfryer.com. Just click the contact link, and you can either fill out a web form or you can send me an email, and I will get that message and love to hear your thoughts, and especially if you've got other ideas for free digital curriculum sources that teachers need to be aware of. I think there's never been a better day to be alive and be a teacher than right now in 2006. And that may sound ridiculous because, you know, we are losing teachers so fast today. We don't have a teacher recruitment problem. We have a teacher retention problem. And we need to keep the teachers that we have in the classroom. We can't do that very well. And there's maybe never been, I don't know, I'm, you know, 30-something years old and I haven't lived a whole long, you know, a long time. But I suspect that we've never had a day where there are more things laid on the plate of the teacher than today, when there are so many things with accountability and testing and special education and individual education plans and, you know, all the things that are on the teacher's plate. I say it's exciting because things have actually changed in a fundamental way in the world. And the thing that's changed is the way information is shared. I mentioned this morning that I'm using a wiki, which is just a web page that I can edit. It says edit page up here, to share the links about E-Rate and curriculum that we're going to talk about today. And I have been keeping a blog for about 2 years now that other people around the world have found. And I'll show you a quick little map here to sort of dramatize the fact that this conversation is going on. My blog is called Moving at the Speed of Creativity. It's just speedofcreativity.org. And this is free information. Anybody can go here and access it. And at the bottom of the page, there is a map that loads up that is connected to IP address. And this just blows me away because I am not a famous person. I do not know Ted Turner. I have not got a contract with somebody to, you know, publish any kind of book. But since September the 4th, and today is the 27th, each one of those dots on this map corresponds to an IP address on the planet of somebody who has pulled up and has been reading information on my blog and listening to things on my podcast. That is unbelievable. I mean, all these people in South America, we've got South Africa, look all across Europe, the middle of the Arabian Peninsula, somebody in Iran, I think that's in Tehran, New Zealand, Australia. Now, I was a geography major in college. Actually, I love geography. And we're going to talk about Google Earth and making geographic connections. But I think that just dramatically indicates that we have a different world here because we have all these voices talking and all these folks sharing information. That raises issues and it raises concerns, but it also provides opportunities. And that's what we're going to talk about today for about an hour, are what kinds of opportunities are there for your teachers, like we saw in that video, to teach differently and engage kids at a different level. I believe that technology is not a panacea. You know, if you go to some conferences, in fact, I'll say their name. I listened to the Texas Instruments calculator presentation at our Texas State Convention this last year, and the man used the words silver bullet.
If you buy this calculator and you use it, it is the silver bullet for your math scores. Well, you know what? It has everything to do with the teacher. And what does that teacher choose to do with that tool, and how does she utilize it and invite the students to utilize it too? When we come to talk about integrating technology, I subscribe to the idea that there are two basic ways I can integrate technology. And the first way is called accommodation learning, using the tool to do something we could do traditionally. And I am being pretty traditional right now. I could be using a chalkboard, I could be using an overhead, but I'm not. I'm using a projector and I'm using a computer. And if I'm just presenting information to you, that's okay, because teachers do that first, right? The longest longitudinal study of integrated teaching to date was the Apple Classrooms of Tomorrow research that concluded in 1998. And they studied what happens when you give teachers all this technology and all the support you can. And it found they went through five different stages. What's the first stage? Well, turning it on, you know, figuring out the basics, but then accommodating your teaching. I'm used to having you write essays, so let's write them with the computer. I'm used to doing some testing and assessment with multiple choice. Let's do that with the technology. And then we graduate on to further levels of technology use. Well, I'm going to start, and I'm only going to show you about five examples today, but I'm going to actually start with one commercial example because it's such a dramatic example of what I would call transformative or level two technology use. I don't care how big your budget is in your high school. You probably don't want to do successive mouse breeding experiments to explore the genetic, you know, variables of breeding different types of mice. I mean, I remember my seventh grade science teacher had a boa constrictor and his own little colony of mice, and the smell just for that little colony of mice was, you know, enough to deter a lot of folks from wandering in that part of the building if they didn't have to. It was very exciting for students, especially when it was feeding time. But the point is, you know, we have limited budgets and we have limited time. And we also just limited practicality. I mean, can we sit here and wait for the mice to breed and then analyze their genetics? Now, I am not a genetic expert and really even a science teacher by certification. My certification, I was a math teacher at elementary school and I taught writing and reading. But I love science and I love this tool. And this is a tool from Explore Learning and it's called a Gizmo. And in the Texas Immersion Pilot Project, when the state of Texas wanted to experiment with all students and all teachers in campuses with laptops, they recognized they couldn't just give those kids and teachers a piece of hardware and say, oh, go teach. You know, go. It's like fire. We had a professor from Stanford, Larry Cuban, write a book called Oversold and Underused a number of years ago, and it analyzed Silicon Valley. If you could pick any school district or community in the country that would really have it with technology, you'd think Silicon Valley would be doing it right. Well, guess what? Most of their computer technology is not being used in this transformative way. So, the state of Maine, under the leadership of Governor Angus King, was the first state in the nation to say, let's give all our middle school students laptops and, you know, provide our teachers with training and support. The state of Texas is, of course, much larger than Maine. In fact, Irving ISD alone, which has a laptop initiative, has more laptops in the hands of kids than the state of Maine does. That kind of puts Texas in perspective a little bit there. You know, so when we talk about integration, we have to give teachers curriculum. Here's a good example of some curriculum. I've loaded this up, and I can drag this mouse. We'll call him the male. I don't know. Male or female. We do know genotype, though, and if we click on these boxes and move our mouse cursor over, we can see that this black furred mouse with black eyes is dominant fur, capital F, capital F, and is dominant with eyes, capital E, capital E. This white mouse with red eyes is recessive on both, okay? And so we know from research on student learning, and we know from our own experiences, that when students can be hands-on with their learning, when they're not just sitting and getting, okay, but when they're actually able to manipulate things and do things, the level of learning goes up. And ideally, if we had an opportunity to, for this even short seminar, I would want all of you to be on laptops and give you a chance to do this. Okay, but short of that, showing this is the next best thing we can do. So, let's breed these mice. What do we get? Well, we move our mouse over these cursor, over each mouse, and we see that each one of these mice babies, or children, what's that? Pups? Are they really called pups? Well, I didn't know that. I'm glad to know that. Mouse pups. They are dominant recessive. Okay? So, fur, dominant recessive, eyes, dominant recessive. Well, interesting. Well, let's move two of these into the holding tank. Clear this out, and we won't debate about breeding siblings here. I've had some complaints about that in the past. We're not going to go there, okay? But we're going to breed these. And what do we get? Wow, we got some different things. We got a mouse that's black-haired with a red eye. We got a white mouse with a black eye. And so, again, we have the opportunity to do things with this experiment that we simply wouldn't be able to do, practically speaking, hands-on, even if we had the funds to do it. So in addition to providing this opportunity for the kids to interact and play around and trial and error, you know, different things, you've also got a set of assessment questions here that they fill out, and that's sent to the teacher, and he or she immediately has a record of what the student's level of mastery is with that particular content area. All right? Phenomenal. Digital curriculum. All right. Now, that's a commercial example, and I wanted to show it to you because I just think it is very powerful about this idea of doing things we couldn't do otherwise without technology. Now, let's go to some free examples, which we're going to spend the rest of the time talking about. And let's talk about the Wikipedia first. Now, I'm not saying you want to pick a fight with a librarian, but if you want to get some interesting discussions going, talk to your librarian about the Wikipedia. How many of you have used the Wikipedia before? Okay. Why is the Wikipedia a contentious topic for education, for librarians, for anybody who's working with information? That is exactly right. That is exactly right, because people can put things into this page. So let's go to the page. We're in Edmond, Oklahoma today. So let's put in Edmond, Oklahoma. And let's pull up the Wikipedia page for Edmond. What? We don't have a page? I haven't actually done a search for Edmond before. Ah, oh, there it is. I needed to spell out Edmond, Oklahoma. So here's the page for Edmond, Oklahoma. And if we would want to, we could actually click this link at the top of this page that says Edit This Page, and we could put information on this page. If I click on History, I can see that the last time this was edited was a few days ago on September 18th. Looks like some people were editing it on the 16th. They were putting more things about geography in Edmond and then famous citizens. Well, this isn't really controversial. Let's pick a page that's maybe a little more controversial. How about the George Bush page? In fact, the John Kerry and George W. Bush pages were closed by Wikipedia during the last election because of virtual vandalism. Now, this says, because of recent vandalism, editing of this article by anonymous or newly registered users is disabled. So I've been a member of Wikipedia. It's free to click and sign in for a while. So if I was to sign in, I could edit this. But you notice edit page is gone from this page. Okay. Well, brings up a lot of issues. About 6 months ago, there was an article that congressional staffers were in hot water because some of the web pages on Wikipedia for certain members of Congress were being vandalized with disinformation. And the Wikipedia people went to the IP logs to find out who was doing that, and guess where the IP range was? It was in the staffers' offices, you know, in Congress, and so they blocked the entire IP range and raised this whole hoopla to say, look, guys, this is ridiculous. So the conversation is, you know, multifaceted. There's a lot of things to talk about here. Let me ask you this. Where do your kids go today when they do research if they have access to the Internet? They go to the Internet. The research bears this out, and just ask them, talk to them. Okay, they tend to go to the Internet first. Does that mean the library doesn't have a place? Absolutely not. The library is vitally important, and we need to fund our libraries and support our librarians more than ever. In fact, I think librarians need to be right at the center of these conversations about what it means to be literate in the 21st century. But the Wikipedia raises some of these issues, and one of those questions is, how do you know it's true? Well, let me ask you this. How do you know anything's true? When you watch Fox News, how do you know that's true? When you watch CNN, how do you know that's true? Because I guarantee you, every journalist is always looking through a lens, and even when they try to be objective, there is a lens they're looking through. Now, something interesting about the information environment that we live in today is, when we grew up, textbooks were the source of information, the encyclopedias. For me, it was the 1969 Encyclopedia Americana. It's still in the basement of my parents' house in Manhattan, Kansas. I bet you every report I wrote in junior high on was paraphrased carefully, hopefully, from the Encyclopedia Americana. Well, a limited number of people wrote that. And history, you can argue, is sort of written oftentimes by the winners. There are a lot of people that haven't necessarily had their history put into the books. And if we look at an instance like the Japanese relocation in World War II, my dad grew up in Powell, Wyoming, which is just east of Yellowstone Park, where Heart Mountain Relocation Camp was, where many Japanese Americans were moved. In fact, the orthodontist I had growing up was at that relocation camp as a child with his family. Was that in our textbook? Did our students have an opportunity to hear about that? When we talk about the war on terror, a lot of people think every Muslim's a terrorist. You know, every Islamic country needs to be attacked and blown up. Well, come on. There are all kinds of people out there who are not terrorists that subscribe to other faiths that are different from ours. There's an importance of studying the past so that we don't repeat its mistakes. And there's an opportunity today to have access to voices that we simply didn't have before. So here's one of the things that I would encourage you to do to find out if Wikipedia is accurate. A couple different things. Somebody give me a topic that you know something about or are fairly literate about. It could be a place. It could be a disease. It could be a medical condition.
Yeah,
PCR. Okay. I can type R.
It says polymerase chain reaction. We know it's smart.
Okay. What is a polymerase chain reaction?
It's how you replicate DNA for the testing that we do on criminals. There's snippets of DNA. It's not much material, so you replicate it and make big quantities of it using PCR.
Wow. So look at the elevator or the sidebar over here to get a feel for how big this Wikipedia article is. If this was a real short Wikipedia article, you wouldn't see very much there. Now, I don't know how much content about PCR is in the average encyclopedia in schools, but one of my favorite things to do in professional development with teachers when we're in the library is have them grab an encyclopedia and say, let's look that up there and here. Wikipedia has over 10 times the content of the traditional encyclopedia now, and it's growing even larger. And the reason I suggest people look up something you know something about is because you'll be able to probably read that and gauge, is this a bunch of bunk? Or, you know, is this fairly accurate? What happens with Wikipedia, and you can click on the history of any page to see the dialogue that's happening, is different people are essentially adopting different pages and they're editing them. Especially on the political pages, like the President Bush page, you'll see them take off, you know, slander or something that's more vandalism than an actual, you know, fact or relevant opinion. And so that kind of thing happens. Another story I love about Wikipedia, in the last year there was a high school student who knew about Wikipedia and had to do a research project. So he went online, found there wasn't a Wikipedia article about that, created one with a couple mouse clicks, and just put a few sentences up there. I don't even think they were, you know, grammatically correct. And he sat back and waited. And over the course of about 2 or 3 weeks, the Wikipedia community built a pretty decent report about his topic. And he highlighted it, copied and pasted into Word, printed it out, and turned it in. Now, I don't know what kind of a grade he received, but certainly his creativity grade should have been pretty high. And I think it also drives home the fact that teachers really shouldn't be assigning the same kinds of assignments they've always given, because the information environment is fundamentally different today. One more quick example is Pikes Peak. We had an attendee last week who knew that the elevation of Pikes Peak has recently been revised because of the GPS technology, and it was wrong. And so he said, yep, 14,115 feet, that's right. And we went into the history and saw that back on August the 25th, the altitude was changed because the geodetic survey data was new. Okay? When was your encyclopedia in your library going to be updated? Now, that may not seem as significant. Okay, it's a couple feet. But let's talk about something like Supreme Court justices of the United States. If I put in U.S. Supreme Court, I should get the current page. And when I was in Miami, Texas, anybody know where Miami is? Okay, it's not far from the Oklahoma border. It's by Pampa. My wife grew up in Canadian, not far there. I heard somebody say recently that rural today is defined by your distance from Walmart. So while Pampa and, you know, Miami may seem rural, Pampa's got a Walmart and Miami's only about 15, 20 miles away. Well, we were there doing a professional development in their school, which is a K-12 school. Everybody's all together. And we had recently had a Supreme Court nominee confirmed by the U.S. Senate. And it was right on the front page. And I think it's Samuel, is it Alito? Does anybody know? Is that how you say his last name? Well, again, when is your encyclopedia going to have this information? It's going to be a while. And it was there immediately. And the content was pretty accurate. So the last point on this is, there was an article in Nature magazine, and I can go to the website Google to search for this. I'm using Firefox, which is another browser that tends to have less malware written for it for Windows, so I use it more. And I'm just going to Google for Nature magazine Wikipedia. You can see I've already done this before. So Nature magazine Wikipedia, out of 5,900,000 hits, the first one is the article from December 2005. And so Nature magazine, a fairly reputable traditional publication, did a comparison between Britannica and Wikipedia. What'd they find? Looking at just scientific articles, you had about 4 to 5 mistakes per article. And the thing that's amazing about that is that Wikipedia is over 10 times the size. So not only does it have greater breadth, it has greater depth. And if you look at that factor, it's actually more accurate. Now, this has obviously caused Britannica to respond, and you can scroll down here and read Britannica's response and Nature's response. But the point is, Wikipedia is a resource that's out there, and it's available free for your kids to use. If you go to the website laptop.org, this is the laptop of the One Laptop Per Child project. My 9-year-old son told me recently that he was saving his money and had, I think, $20. He said, "Dad, you know what I'm saving for." I said, "What, son?" He said, "Dad, it's orange." And this is a picture of the prototype. They've got the keyboard down to $5, the display down to $35. These little rabbit ears are the wireless connectors. Yes, that is a USB port. The whole thing's down to $135. And these are going to start shipping in 2007, as I mentioned, to countries that agree to buy one for every kid. Well, where's the curriculum going to come from? Well, Wikipedia is one source of that. So I really think that you want your teachers and your students to be talking about these kinds of issues. How do we determine if something's true? Well, when we grew up and we just had a textbook and we just had an encyclopedia, there wasn't a lot of debate about it. You know, that's what we have. But there are so many sources and so many voices, we've got to talk about it. And on this issue, a final example. Are you familiar with this website, martinlutherking.org? If I do a search for Martin Luther King, it depends. Yep, there it is. Look at this. This is ridiculous. Your kids go do this. I'm not doing any tricks, okay? I just did a Google search for Martin Luther King. The first, second hit out of 35 million says Martin Luther King, a true historical examination. And the website's martinlutherking.org. You might think, oh, that sounds legitimate. That's just not somebody's GeoCities or, you know, free website that they link to. This may be blocked depending upon how the school filter is set up. But this website is hosted by a group called stormfront.org. You used to have to do some more hunting because at the bottom it would say questions, email webmaster@stormfront.org. Well, who the heck's that? This is probably blocked. Maybe not. Stormfront.org is a white supremacist group. And so they have licensed or registered the domain martinlutherking.org. There it is, white pride worldwide. Now, some people would say, oh my gosh, there's no way we should have kids accessing any of that at school. And I mentioned in terms of SEPA compliance that there's not a published blacklist that the government sends out that says you have to block all this. I think we need to be talking with students about this. Students need to be able to understand that they can't just believe things they find online. They need to validate information. And so whether they're using the Wikipedia or some other source, they need to ask questions about who else is saying that. Well, what group is behind that group that published that? Do they have, you know, backers and sponsors? It's all about critical thinking. And really, critical thinking is not a 21st century skill. We've always needed critical thinking. But I think our changed information environment can highlight maybe a little more dramatically the need for it. So, that is Wikipedia. Let me go next to the second link, which is called the National Library of Virtual Manipulatives. Probably the coolest, sexiest, if I can use that word, free manipulative I'm going to show you today. All of your districts have teachers teaching math, okay? And math is one of those core things we hear a lot about. We want kids to learn more about math. I was a math teacher, and probably the best thing I learned in my preparation program for teaching math came from a person named Jerome Bruner, who talked about how we don't do enough with kids in the concrete understanding of math and the transition to the abstract. Did any of you have the privilege of taking calculus? Okay. Would anybody be willing to come up and explain how to do a derivative today? Don't ask me to, actually. Okay. Because a lot of times with those higher order math skills, we move right over to that symbolic level, okay? So there's a lot of value in working with a concrete level, and hopefully your math teachers are using manipulatives with students to get this, you know, connection. Kids come to us with all kinds of math knowledge, right? Let's look at pizza, what we had today. I mean, even a young child can talk about division and fairness and things. So manipulatives is a very sound practice. This is coming from the Utah State University, and this is all correlated to NCTM, which is the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics. So those math pass standards we have in Oklahoma are tied to content area standards, and so even though this is Utah, we're going to see a lot of things. So give me a content area of math, number operations, algebra, geometry, measurement, data analysis and probability, and then give me a grade level range. And we'll take a look at just maybe two or three of the tools that are here. Okay, I heard several things.
I said number operations 3 through 5.
Okay, number and operations 3 through 5. So I click on that box, and it's going to pull up the digital manipulatives that correlate to that particular content area. And again, this runs through the web browser, so I can do this from any computer connected to the internet. This is a wonderful tool to use with an interactive smart board, all right? Because instead of sitting here on my laptop, I could be up as a teacher, but even better, I can have the kids up here interacting and doing this kind of stuff. And so let me just go to bar chart.
So do 35th graders know what integers are?
Do you know what? If that is an amazing thing, because yes, fifth graders, I mean, you talk about integers, you talk about, you know, factorizations. It is amazing the kinds of math operations that we're asking our kids to do at low levels. So it's just an eye-opener sometimes to see what we're asking them to do. In order to get this to run, the first time you go to this website in Internet Explorer or Firefox or whatever, it's going to say, you know, you need to have this Java virtual machine running on your computer. And so that's going to load up. And once this loads in my web browser, I'm really not going to have to interact with the website anymore. It's just going to pull this, it's going to have this information loaded as a program inside the browser window. Here's a little teachable moment that's not coming up. What's a good idea? Try again. Close it up. Oh gosh, look at that. It's a free site that I have just signed up to use. Anybody can go to that website, pbwiki.com, and set up a wiki. So it's just one that I chose to use. I found it's great for any kind of collaborative project. I like to talk about meeting teachers with the vocabulary they have, and teachers understand, you know, collaborative learning and group projects. And, you know, a wiki, like we saw in the history, tracks every contribution that they made. That's one of the biggest challenges of doing a project is who skated through, you know? Joe sat over here, and he did something the last night, and he's going to try to get the same grade as Susie, who, you know, did all the work. So it tracks that kind of thing and can be a very good tool for not only facilitating collaboration, but also tracking what people did. And kids know it's time and date stamped. If I wait till the last day to do my contribution, then that's going to show up. All right, so we tried a different web browser here. Let's just do a quick pet survey because this is something that we can do quickly. So probably some of us have kids. What other kind of pets do we have at home? Okay, we might have a cat. What else? Dog. A fish. Ooh. Snake. Hamster. Somebody said rabbit. Okay, if I need to have more columns, I just click this button. Okay, get another column. Somebody say guinea pig. I'll say G-pig. All right, so let's do our little survey. How many of you have kids? Okay, hands up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Oh, I've got to adjust my scale. So I just click here, adjust my scale up, 15 kids. Let me have a cat. Just 3, 4 cat owners. Okay, how many have a dog? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. How many fish? You should be faster. 1 fish. How many snakes? 1 snake. Hamsters? Rabbit? Guinea pig? Okay. So I can get totals, which isn't that amazing, but I can also get percentages, and that's based on respondents. I can do this in Excel, right? But what a wonderful tool. We graph all the time in school. We need to be connecting math to different content areas. And so again, if I had used the smart board, this is a very cool tool because I can be doing that with the smart board. You know, it's a free tool. At the top of this, I've used this before, so I didn't have to, but I can click on instructions and get information about activities and parent-teacher connections for this. And that's common across tools. I think you would have to use the print screen command and then copy and paste it. Or like with a smart board, you have a capture tool, and so you could capture it and bring it right into your notepad program if you wanted to use that. Let me do another one. This is factor trees, okay? So I can do 1 or 2 factor trees. I can have the computer generate it or the user. Let's do one ourselves. Somebody give me a large number, not a 7-digit number, but like a
952.
Okay, 952. So let's factor that number. Now, if I'm not sure what to do, I can click over here on instructions, and I get a pop-up menu telling me about this manipulative allows us to construct factor trees for two numbers and then prime factorization using least common multiple, greatest common factor. If I click on standards, I'm going to get a pretty typical layout of what is the NCTM standard that is addressed by this digital manipulative. Okay, and again, your state pass standards for Oklahoma are correlated to NCTM. Parent and teacher is going to give me information about why it's a good idea to use this. Okay, why don't we want kids to just, you know, learn how to factor by just paper and pencil? Why is a manipulative good? Or in some cases, why is this technique good? So, somebody give me a factor of 952. All right. If we keep up with that, it is going to be a long factorization, but we could try something else. We know it's even, so we can keep on trying too. Anything else we could try for 476? Let's see if 4 works. Oh, it does. Okay, so what's a factor of 4? 2. Factor of 119?
1.
Besides 1. Is there anything else? Is it prime? No, I try it. It says, please try a different number. 3?
7.
Very good. Okay. So, do our kids need to know how to do this with paper and pencil? Sure they do. But is this a phenomenal tool to teach factorization? Would kids be a little more engaged to be able to come up and interact in this way? Probably so. All right. So let me show you one more. And this time, I'm going to pick data analysis and probability for grades 6 through 8, and I want to do coin tossing. I think I'll probably stop at this one. Okay, because again, this demonstrates the power of the technology. If I'm going to sit here and flip coins, okay, if I'm going to flip 100 coins, am I always going to get 50 heads and 50 tails? Well, how do you know? Have you done it? Maybe you have. And we could do that, all right? But we also can use the technology. So let me click start. It's going to flip a coin 100 times. There's 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 tosses. We got 57 tails. We got 43 heads. Our longest run of heads was 5. Our longest run of tails was 8. And so another example of how, you know, a tool like this can be utilized to do things that either we wouldn't have time to do or we simply wouldn't do because it wouldn't be practical.
Is there a max number you can put up there as far as how many times it tosses?
I don't think so. I think you can put whatever you want. And it's just got a, obviously a delay, you know, to make it look like it's taking time. It really could get the answer right away. So there's lots of other kinds of examples and tools. I'll do this one, the last one. Sticker switch. Do you remember Let's Make a Deal? Kids may not. Okay, this probability game is an example of the electronic game show Let's Make a Deal by Monty Hall. So you pick a door, and then you get to choose. Do you want a stick or switch? Only one door has a prize. And so the probability issue here is, what strategy is the best? Is it best to stick? Is it best to switch? Is it best to alternate? Well, you all tell me. Would you like the door on the top, the door on the left, or the door on the right? Let's do the left door, okay? And so we choose, and we've got the door on the left if we want it. The one on top is not the prize. It is the plunger. So the question is, stick or switch? Let's stick. Okay, so we stick with our choice, and we win. Great job, okay? So
you win the first class. Either the children would have to put this on a projector,
right,
or whatever, the class,
right,
or a smart board, or individual.
Right, it can be a whole class activity like we're doing today. You can have them go, if you've got a computer lab, and you could introduce it as whole class, and then they go and individually do it. If you've got a, you know, group of garden of computers or whatever, you could have students rotate through and have it as a center activity, or, you know, various ways. But with the smart boards, the thing I really emphasize with teachers is really making it interactive, because the teacher could be up there doing all the work, but the power is getting the kids involved. All right, so let's do two more of these, and then I'm going to show you the multiple games feature. You want the top door, bottom, or left or right? Let's go with the right this time, and oh, got that plunger again. You still want a stick or you want to switch? Let's switch this time and see. Ah, we won again, okay? So we're doing pretty good. We're batting 100% for two games. Let's play one more time. What door do you want? Go for the top and stick or switch. We're going to stick this time, all right? Oh, look at that. Now, I don't want you to run out to the casino right away after we do this.
I thought you were paying.
This is free, remember? Because if we do the multiple games feature, you're going to see that our little experiment of three games and winning every time and sticking, twice, is really probably not going to pay off for us. So let's do 100 games with one strategy. Do you want to stick? Do you want to switch? Or you want to alternate in between? Let's alternate. Sure, let's hedge our bets. Okay, let's go. Let's play 100 games. And what happens? About 50-50. We won 48. We lost 52. Okay. I don't really like that odd, you know, those odds. I'd rather do a little bit better. So which of the other options do you think will work better, switching or sticking? Okay, let's stick. And if we always stick with our first choice, every time, statistically speaking, we will only win about a fourth of the time. We won 25% of the time. If you switch every single time, you will tend to win about two-thirds of the time and lose only a third. How does that work? Well, if you go to strategy, it's going to say, if you always stick with your initial choice, how often will you win? And I think that was a third. That's correct. If you always switch, how often will you lose? You'll lose a third. And if you play in games, how many of the games can you expect to win with the strategy of and apply the strategy of switching in exactly half the games? Ooh, that's kind of tricky. How many games could you expect to win? That is correct. All right, so pretty cool. And again, I'm sure all of you have got teachers who are looking for ways to get kids more engaged. I heard someone say a while back that you don't really meet many hammer-only carpenters. Okay? They just use a hammer. Why? Because if you give me a nail gun and I'm a carpenter, I'm going to be able to put up that fence, you know, in a fraction of the time. I'm going to be crazy not to look at tools that could help me do my job better. And any teacher worth their salt knows that one way is not going to get all the kids to learn any concept, whether that's reading or math or anything else. So that is the National Library of Virtual Manipulatives. I'm just going to show you a couple more here. How many of you have used Google Earth? Okay, a few people have used Google Earth. Just like I was telling you about OpenOffice as a great tool that's free, and it's no longer, don't copy that floppy, it's going to be please download and share this. Google Earth has a free version that runs on Windows, Mac, Linux, and any of your kids can use this, your teachers can use it. So I've given you a link on the handout or the webpage to Google Earth, and I've also given you a link to Google Earth Hacks. Google Earth Hacks is a website that has all kinds of locations on the planet, and you can put in something like I put in meteor, and so there are lots of meteor locations, and in fact I'll show you, there's a database of... Well, that's a little irritating, I'll turn that volume off. I don't think I had my volume up for that before. There's a link that shows you every meteorite hit impact on the entire planet. The one that I have isn't working now, but there's also live aircraft tracking. It's like 5 minutes delayed, but every inbound aircraft to JFK, Miami, Chicago, LAX, where are they on the planet? It's just amazing. So, I've launched Google Earth, and we are today in Edmond, Oklahoma. So if I put in Edmond, Oklahoma and hit enter, we are going to start flying there. And we are in a urban area, so the resolution of the satellite imagery that has been pieced together is pretty good for our area. When we go out to rural Oklahoma, you're going to see that the resolution isn't quite as good. But you can actually get down to the street level and look at individual houses. Kids are.
Put in 1001 West Danforth.
Danforth Road, Edmond, Oklahoma, and let's fly there. Here we go. Okay, so it's going to go to that location, and we can zoom in, and there's the parking lot. Now, some of the... That's not it? This is us here. Now, some of these images are a few years old. When we did parts of Lubbock where we lived, we could see new construction that happened in about 2002 and, you know, could kind of date the images. But anytime we want to make a connection to a place on the planet, Google Earth is a great tool to use.
Hey, Wes, one other word. Put in Mancos, M-A-N-C-O-S. Colorado. And then show us the tilt function.
Okay, MAN.
COS.
COS.
That's my hometown.
Colorado?
Yeah, Colorado. And you can see the mountains there in the Durango area. And the tilt gives you the 3D topo, which is really cool. If you've never seen this before on Google, it's amazing. Quite a bit show.
Now, as it downloads, okay, so we're gonna tilt the Earth here. My other east. Okay, it depends on what I have loaded. Let me check terrain.
You don't have the terrain.
Okay, so let me load up terrain and let me go there again. So there's different layers that we can put on here. Okay, and now I've got the terrain loaded up. And so now we've got mountains. Okay, we're going to do a project about volcanoes. All right, let's go to Mount St. Helens. We can set this up by, where are we going to fly? That's a live webcam image, by the way, of the Mount St. Helens caldera because it's just linked into the website. And here we are flying into Mount St. Helens. There's the location of the webcam. Again, I have terrain turned on, so I can play with my pan and scroll features. And I'll probably be able to pick out Mount Rainier. I think that's maybe Mount Baker. That's Rainier. I had a chance to go to Seattle a few years ago and just... I know it wasn't representative, but 3 of the 4 days we were there, we could see Rainier. It was so beautiful. So I used this the other day when I was down in Greenville School, which is in by Marietta, Oklahoma, in South Central Oklahoma. And I was working with a teacher who we had done a video conferencing sort of awareness workshop. And she wanted to do some video conferencing with her students and also help improve writing scores. And so we set up a blog, which some people hear the word blog and they think, oh, MySpace, it's dangerous. But there are moderated blogs that can be set up where the teacher has control not only over what students publish, but over what comments are published there too. And I really believe we need to help kids get more excited about writing. Would you agree that if kids are more excited about writing, they'll write more? And if they write more, what do we know? They write better and they learn to read better. Okay, these are basic concepts about time on task and motivation. And so technology can be a lever in this way. So what I did was I created what I called a classroom blog tour, world blog tour. And so these are to different classrooms around the world that are using blogs, and we can go to their live blogs. So you all tell me where you want to fly, and we'll go to like 2 of these places. We can go to Connecticut, Fairbanks, Alaska, Melbourne, Australia, Mountain Brook, Alabama, Omaha, Nebraska, San Antonio, Seattle, Snow Lake, Manitoba, Wells, Maine. Let's go to Australia. So if we wanted to, I can go ahead and click on Marietta. So let's kind of start off. We'll tilt the planet here again. So we're looking straight at it. And again, the kids can be up here doing this stuff, right? Whether you have a smart board or not, they're interacting, they're flying around, going to these different places. And so here we're going to start South Central Oklahoma. And we set this up by talking about, well, where would we go if we're going to go to Australia? Okay, any bets for closest distance? We're going to head west or we're going to head east? We have some bets for east. Anybody want to take west? Let's see. We double click and west it is. So here we fly across the Pacific Ocean all the way to the southeastern part of Australia. And you quickly start to realize Melbourne is a very large place with large buildings and lots of streets. And again, you've got the same opportunity for students to interact with tilting and moving around. But here's the thing. I can click on this link and go to the student's classroom blog. And it will load up here in Google Earth in this bottom window after my internet catches up with me. And then I can click a button that'll take me out of Google Earth to my web browser, and I can see this website. And it looks like... oh, well, cool. This was from September the 9th, and look at this. I haven't even read this. Our class blog has been linked to a school in Oklahoma in the USA. Maybe it would be good to go over and have a look and leave some comments. It's time to start recognizing some good blog posts written by bloggers in our very own class. Claire writes in a very natural voice about things she is interested in, television shows she likes, etc. Man, that's cool. So I didn't even know that they had done that. So kids have an opportunity today to get involved in a global conversation that's happening around the world. We hear a lot of press about predators and MySpace, and I really do believe we need to protect kids, absolutely. But at the same time, we can't just tell kids, don't do that, don't go there, you know, stay off the internet, because they are going to be on the internet, and there are good constructive things they can do on the internet. Anybody had the pleasure of helping their teenager learn how to drive? Okay, anybody done that before? My oldest is 9, or almost 9. We're not there yet. But I make an analogy to driving, okay? Most of us would agree we're not handing the keys to our teenagers without a period of mentorship and apprenticeship and helping them learn how to be safe on the road. Are they going to make mistakes? They're teenagers, okay? But we want to hopefully be around when they make some mistakes so that the learning can take place and the potential injury can be minimized. So I really think that we need to not just talk the talk of internet safety, but we need to find ways to walk the walk. And I don't have it linked here, but I just did an interview with the co-founder of a program called MBE, which is based out of San Francisco. I was driving between Claremore and McAllister last week, and I stopped at Henrietta, which is right there on I-40, and went to the public library with free internet access, and I got on Skype and called this guy on his cell phone, and we did a Skype cast. And so this is an environment which is, it's kind of like parents would let their kids maybe go play in a backyard of the neighbor, and you could see in that yard, and you could check up on them and see what was happening. There was a fence around it, so it wasn't likely that somebody from the street was just going to come in. This is basically what the MB environment is, and so teachers can sign up, and their kids can write blog posts and post pictures and send messages to this community that they manage. But the parent is involved, and the parent can moderate every post that goes up there, or just moderate. Okay, check, and you get an email every day. What happened with my kid? This is specifically targeted towards 8 through 14 year olds. I'll put a link to that. I don't have that on here. So, all right. Well, I want to wrap up here in the next 10 minutes. So let me show you just a couple more things quickly, and we will be done. I've got to show you a primary example. I told you I was an elementary teacher. Anybody heard of Roy, Tale of the Singing Zebra? Probably haven't, because it's just about brand new, I think. This is a website from the United Kingdom. And it's a great example of what I would call a multimedia book. You could go buy software that would do this, but this is completely free. And so I click on part one, and it says a pop-up menu is blocked. Let me go back here to Firefox and see. I could unblock. I don't use Internet Explorer a lot. So we'll set this up. Okay, so I click on story, and I've got different parts to the story. Some of these, if I turn my volume off, again, a great tool to use with a smart board. And I, as a primary teacher, helping my kids learn to read, part one, the worst zoo in the world. We can do some choral reading. I won't have you all do this, but together we could all read in a land far away. There is a zoo, but it's not a nice one. And so this is a story that we could go through, access together. And some of the story features have multimedia elements. But in addition, you've got interactive literacy games. And so I'll go to those and click on words that rhyme. Let's do words that rhyme with top. Okay. Again, this is running through the web browser. Words that rhyme with top. Nap.
Oopsie.
Nope. Bop.
Yes.
Dot. No. Dip. Chop.
Yes.
And lock.
Yes.
All right. So you get the idea. And this is free, accessible to anyone who has an internet connection. Is that the only answer you need for your curriculum in schools for reading? No, of course not. But it's a pretty cool site, and it's a resource that your teachers could utilize, again, to help develop those literacy skills. I want to talk a little bit about student research, and then I want to wrap up by talking about Voices and the Library of Congress. What newspaper do y'all read? Does anybody, y'all take The Oklahoman, Edmund Sun, any other newspapers anybody else takes? Anybody take New York Times or USA Today? Okay. Well, if we think about traditional news sources, usually we have a fairly limited palette of choices. Most people are familiar with the main Google website, okay, google.com. But if you click news right here at the top, you'll go to the Google News site that tracks over 4,500 news sources simultaneously worldwide 24/7. If we put in a topic like Iraq, there are going to be a lot of articles about Iraq, but not only are there going to be a lot of articles, so there's one from USA Today 3 hours ago, but there's Reuters, there's the International Herald Tribune in France. Here's the Age newspaper in Australia. Okay? What are these people saying? Here's a South Korean article. The point is, our students live in a global world. If you've heard of The World is Flat by Tom Friedman, if you haven't read that, get that book and read it. Okay? Get your principals, or if you're not the superintendent, invite your superintendent to read it, because that book really talks about how this world is different. Here's a resource tool for them, okay, to access news content from traditionally published news sources that have an online presence. But in addition to Google News, I want you to know about Global Voices Online. You could have a Spanish teacher who's having her students learn about Mexico or learn about Argentina. And in addition to doing traditional research in the Wikipedia, in the school library encyclopedias, the school books, we have access to people who are blogging, but this is an edited blog where Harvard University set this up, and they have editors around the world that find bloggers in these countries. Somebody give me the name of a country to click on.
Italy.
Let's go to Italy. So if we click on Italy, there aren't any bloggers there. Interesting.
About Rwanda.
Yeah. Do we have Rwanda here? Okay. Interesting. Somebody said Australia too, and Australia is not on here. So here are Rwandan bloggers, okay, posting. Oh, they haven't posted since July 21st. But access to somebody who is either, in general, living in Rwanda or who is a Rwandan living outside the country. Anybody know what happened to in Thailand last week?
Yeah,
a little coup d'état. Okay, they had a United Nations meeting, and the leader of Thailand was in New York giving a speech. And what happened? The military seized power. Well, not only can you get news sources about that, but here's a post from September 20th, Thailand, situation on the street. Thailand under military rule, day one, looks like a regular day here, except there were fewer people on the street, and they go in and talk.
Do they have it posted in Spanish, or is it in English?
Most of the time they'll have both. Like, let me go to Guatemala. It depends upon the language the person is posting in, because a lot of folks, now this is about global food, so you've got things about culture, not just political events too. It depends on what they're posting in. So if they originally posted it in another language, generally you'll have a translation and then you'll have a link to that language too. There you go. Feliz Día de la Mujer. Okay, so you got some people that are blogging in what are called bridge blogs, and they're the ones that are translating the languages. So, one more thing I want to show you. And how many of you have been to the Library of Congress? Anybody been to the Library of Congress in Washington, D.C.? Okay. Amazing, right? The largest library in the world. Well, guess what? We have access to it through the internet. And this is just one part of the library. It's called the American Memory Section. And I love social studies, and I believe one of the best ways to get kids to understand history isn't just stuff written in a textbook, but it's the lived experiences of people, is to put them in touch with the first-person accounts. And so if I did a search for Oklahoma, and I won't do this when I'm going to show you something else, we could actually pull up 1904 film footage by Thomas Edison that was shot of driving cattle to sale, you know, in Oklahoma. We have access to that footage through the internet. If I go here under African American history, you mentioned interest in black history, there are actual slave narratives, audio interviews of slaves that were in the United States, and we can, look at this, Fountain Hughes, age 101. These were tapes that were transcribed. Let's see if I got my... and then posted onto the internet. And so I can play this file and not just talk about what a slave's experience might have been like. I can hear this man telling his story.
My name is Fountain Hughes. I was born in Charlottesville, Virginia. My grandfather belonged to Thomas Jefferson. My grandfather was 115 years old when he died. And now I am 101 years old. That's it. Excuse me, what? Well, what she mean, I don't know. I never asked her.
You just go ahead and talk away there. You don't mind me, Mr. Brown?
No. And when now your husband and you both are young.
So, we won't play more. But here's what I want you to take away from today, hopefully. We've talked about E-rate. We've talked about the complexities of that. And the whole purpose, I think, of doing all that has to do with teaching and learning. It has to do with the interactive and you know, hopefully engaging opportunities we provide for students to learn and to get the skills that they need. And so all these resources are linked from our website. And I'll leave you with one quotation, and that is a question. And that is whether or not you and the teachers in your school district are preparing kids for their future or for your past. And a lot of times what we see happening in school is the same kind of traditional education that we've had for years. In many cases, doing a great job helping kids learn, but I'm telling you, we have too many dropouts, okay, in this state and in this nation. We can pay for it now or pay for it later. And we don't want to pay for that with kids in prison and, you know, folks not making constructive contributions to society. I believe we want to engage kids, and technology is not the silver bullet, you know. It's the teacher's the silver bullet. You want to know the truth. You've got to have a good, passionate teacher. But the technology can really be a powerful tool, and that's one of the reasons I'm here as the advocate with AT&T, is to work with you all and help you do some of these things with your teachers that are going to get kids engaged, help them learn, and ultimately help them become constructive, contributing members of our society that, you know, carry the torch forward. So, thank you for your attendance. I'll be glad to answer questions. I've got some cards if you want to follow up, you know, with my phone number and stuff like that. Let us know how we can help you with your E-rate, and if we can come out and talk to your teachers about professional development, we will do that too.
Moving at the Speed of Creativity podcasts are independently produced and syndicated for a global audience by Wesley Fryer, and are shared under a Creative Commons Attribution 2.5 license. Learn more at www.speedofcreativity.org.